WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rats command a perverse celebrity status. Nature's mobsters, flora and fauna's serial killers, writes Robert Sullivan in his new book, Rats. They breed in filth and they carry disease. In fact, they spread the plague, the Black Death of the Middle Ages. Centuries later, they're still all around us, even when they're hiding out of sight. It wasn't difficult for Robert Sullivan to find a colony of rats to study. He chose a trash-filled alley just a block or two from Wall Street and what used to be the World Trade Center. He waited night after night to watch the rats come out and feed. After also traveling with exterminators and doing historical research, he wrote his book Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. He's also the author of The Meadowlands and A Whale Hunt, and has written for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. Let's start with a short reading from his rat journal, describing one evening in his rat alley.
6:50. Out across Fulton Street, the garbage from the Burger King is dragged out, as I imagine is happening at fast food restaurants all over New York and around this time. A small mountain of garbage bags forms, a vile and grease-dripping, sedimentary New York City occurrence that nightly turns the streets into miniature badlands to be eroded by morning, assuming the sanitation workers arrive, after which there will be dark stains on the concrete, like sweat on the morning rocks of a mountain. 6:57. More garbage, more rats. So many more that it's becoming difficult to concentrate. There are too many rats now, more than a dozen visible at any time, squads constantly surfacing, resurfacing. In the foreground are the young rats. In the back, the larger rats, the rats that must be older, given their size. When I venture up with binoculars, I can see their mottled coats, the bite marks, on one, a gash-like scar. I see also specialty diversions, rat performers in a circus of trash, affording much entertainment for the alley watcher. A rat climbs up a garbage bag, stops at the summit, appears to look around. The rat jumps nearly straight up, in fact, jumps for what my later measurements will show to be 1 foot, up, up, and onto the old ledge of a boarded-up window. The rat walks along the ledge and turns behind the rusted old steel window bars to face the alley again, then lowers himself down onto a bag back close to the wall, a bag that is inaccessible from the alley floor. 7:15. The rats are drunk on food, I think, technically speaking. All a rat needs is 3 to 4 ounces of food a day, but these rats seem to be greatly exceeding that amount, and wouldn't you? It's not at all difficult to picture the rat eating at its food source until the food source is destroyed, cleaned out, until the rat must move on to the next alley, the next street, the next neighborhood.
That's Robert Sullivan reading from his new book, Rats. Robert, why did you want to spend a year observing rats in a New York alley?
I feel like saying it wasn't my fault. I didn't mean to do it. Sometimes I don't know why at all, and other times it seems I can't believe I wasn't doing it sooner. I like to go places where rats tend to be, and, you know, alleys and swamps and garbage dumps, all the places that nobody wants to go to. It turns out that rats are kind of the theme park mascot of my places that I like. But the other thing happened was I was writing a book about a whale hunt, about a tribe, Native American tribe, and they were hunting a whale. And everybody, of course, came up to say you can't hunt a whale. The tribe said we should be able to, maybe. And some people said you should. It was a big to-do about whales. And I started reading about whales and why we kind of love whales. And I read about how we went from being a whaling nation and whaling, you know, the whales out of the world pretty much, to being a nation that kind of loves whales, loves dolphins, especially loves dolphins. And we feel we're on a parallel. Sometimes some people think we can communicate with dolphins. We're like dolphins. And then I started thinking, well, what's the creature that nobody feels like they can think like? The creature that nobody wants to say, I went swimming with rats tonight, you know, in a lagoon in Florida. And that ends up being rats. So this is the creature that I want to check out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how did you choose your spot to observe rats?
Well, I have a friend from high school, my friend Dave, and we still hang out even since high school. And we decided to kind of go out looking for the perfect place to look for rats. Of course, we asked our wives if it's all right if we went out after dinner to look for rats. And my wife said that would be fine as long as I went with Dave. It's very important to her that I'm with somebody when I'm out there looking at rats. Although, after a while, I was going alone. I got to know my alley. But we just kind of went into downtown Manhattan at night. I'd gotten some tips from some exterminators that around the seaport would be a good area. First, we found this abandoned McDonald's. It was kind of filled with rats. What was amazing was, initially, we looked in the McDonald's. We went by it maybe a couple times that night, or we looked in it at first and saw nothing. But then we went back, and we realized it was filled with rats. We just didn't know how to see them. And this is an exciting thing you learned early on, is that there's all this stuff going on in places that you don't know stuff is going on. You can't see rats. That doesn't mean they're not there. Anyway, we ended up going beyond that to this little alley that was kind of between two restaurants. And it was just, we realized, really full of rats. And moreover, there was this great kind of multicultural food supply. And finally, this was just a great small alley that I felt like I'd maybe seen once but hadn't seen. People were walking by it and not noticing it. And that felt like the perfect place, a place that everybody passed by and nobody saw.
Now, rats are nocturnal animals. When do they start coming out?
They come out on cue. It's amazing. They come out right after the sunset, just before it gets dark. They come out first, and they do an initial feeding. As I'm saying this, I can't believe that this really happens, but it really happens. They kind of get an initial, you know, run through. It's sort of like breakfast. Then if it's a heavy alley, an alley with a lot of garbage, you'll see them continue to be out. But they'll go back into their nests. And in this particular alley, that meant that they would sometimes go back down through the cracks in the cobblestones, back down into the street, into the hill, which was very, very amazing. But anyway, then they'll come out again kind of in the middle of the night, and they'll oftentimes come out for another big feeding before sunset. It's the reverse of our day.
I always associate rats with garbage. Do rats have a preference for food that's rotting? Or if we left like fresh food out for them, would they be eating that as much as the garbage?
Well, rats like garbage, but there's different kinds of garbage. And many people think of garbage, rightfully, as garbage. But if you take apart garbage, you see that, there's all different parts to it. And rats won't eat rancid food. They won't go for stale or bad food necessarily. They'll take what they like first. And I think it's written in the rat literature that a rat might starve in an alley full of raw carrots. Rats, generally speaking, are not crazy about their vegetables. They like fried foods. They like fatty foods. A really fun thing about the rat food preference list is that it matched up very nicely with the human food preference list. And,
right.
You know, like a gourmet magazine, I could just see a rat sitting down saying, oh, yeah, I got to make that out of last week's garbage. But a rat discerns within garbage. And another interesting thing about rat food and garbage is that rats develop kind of a preference, a palate that matches the neighborhood. And I'd sort of heard this. I'd heard from exterminators who'd said that, my rats like this kind of spicy food and my rats like this kind of food. And it's pretty interesting to think that a rat would develop an interest in the food that matched the culture, the ethnicity that lived in that neighborhood. It's pretty exciting.
So what was like the creepiest or scariest moment for you when you were in the alley that you adopted observing the rats?
There were many creepy, disturbing moments. But the most sort of rat-oriented, rat-freaky moment would definitely have to be when I was in this one alley with my friend Dave and another friend Matt, and I had to kind of turn away people from going ratting with me. Oftentimes people would say, you know, could I go to your rat alley? And that's the kind of thing, you can't let everybody go to your rat alley. It gets out of hand. So At one point, I did, though, bring a second friend when we were thinking about maybe trapping rats and so forth. Something that didn't work out the way I'd hoped. Anyway, Matt and Dave were in the alley, and there was a guy named Derek who was kind of living around the alley, and he seemed to have some control over the rats in this alley. And this was another alley from my alley, but it was definitely a rat-filled alley. And he orchestrated the movement of the rats, Derek did. And Derek began calling upon the rats and beating with a stick and beating metal, and the rats then started running out all at once. And we went over the numbers immediately after. Dave and Matt and I went over the numbers. And there were definitely, we want to say thousands of rats, but there weren't. There were somewhere between 100 and 200 rats. There were a lot of rats, and they were all coming down the alley. This is a tough thing to experience if you're just a person in sneakers and light camping gear. And here comes this pack of rats, which of course I'd read about, you know, many times but never seen. And the pack of rats is coming. And what was most amazing was as soon as they hit this corner, corner of an old abandoned building, they all took a left, and it was just like watching everybody come off of Lexington Avenue and sneak into that small subway entrance that's around 59th or 58th. Everybody went down a single file. It went from crazed mass pack of rats to single file. Okay, around the corner, we're going down this hole now. It was incredible.
Well, you know, although you were really fascinated to find this alley that was filled with rats every night, it's not a good thing that the city has alleys like that. You were able to find it pretty easily. Do you think, like, the health department knew about it?
Well, I made a mistake in mentioning one alley that I was kind of thinking about checking out to the health department, which I have to say is a very, very good health department. And very shortly thereafter, there were no more rats in that alley. So I tried to not say anything about the alley that I settled on for my studies, just to see what would happen if I didn't interfere with it.
My guest is Robert Sullivan. His new book is called Rats. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Sullivan. We're talking about his new book, Rats. And he spent a year off and on observing rats in one alley near the former World Trade Center. And then he also did a lot of research on rats, their behavior, the history of rats, and so on. I thought of your research studying rats and September 11th as being just, you know, totally unrelated. But after September 11th, a lot of public health researchers were worried that there might be some kind of terrorism through rats, like some spreading of plague, for instance. So exterminating rats actually became a very important part of terrorism prevention after September 11th. And you were able to observe some of that. Can you talk first about what specifically the fears were?
Well, the fears were of the plague. Because plague is one of the weapons of choice for bioterrorism, as I understand it from talking to the CDC and so on, and talking from the New York Health Department, and rats spread the plague. Spreading plague via rats would not be the best way to go about it if you wanted for some crazy reason to do that. There's other ways that you would go about it. But this is rats once wiped out a huge portion, as many people know, of Europe, like a third of Europe, during the Black Death. It wasn't rats, though. It was the fleas on the rats. So after 9/11, people came in and said, "Well, wait a minute. What's going to happen with rats?" Well, there's a lot of stuff around. There's not going to be a lot of people around. So rats will have, you know, they'll start, the population might explode. And it did explode, except that the city moved in to kind of circle the area with what they call bait stations. So they put out poison all around the World Trade Center to try to stop a huge explosion in the rat population.
Was it effective?
Well, people came in afterwards and said, "Oh, there were rats all around there." The one thing I know is if they hadn't done what they'd done, there would have been a lot of rats. I mean, I saw in different neighborhoods that there were rats, but they definitely prevented a lot of rats. But an interesting thing, if there's plague in your city and rats were spreading it, then you wouldn't want to necessarily come in and kill the rats. You'd think, okay, we have plague, let's get rid of the rats. But in fact, you would maybe want to keep rats alive and think about a way to get rid of the fleas on the rats. Because if you killed the rats, then the fleas infected with plague would jump off the rats and onto either the next rat or, since you're killing rats, the next warm-blooded mammal it could find. And being a warm-blooded mammal myself, you know, you want to watch out with that. So that was an interesting thing to learn, that if there was plague, you wouldn't necessarily want to kill the rats.
You know, I was surprised to read that warfarin, which is an anticoagulant that is prescribed to a lot of people, particularly after stroke, it's to prevent blood clotting. That's one of the things that is used as a poison to kill rats. How does it work in rats?
I think they have sort of an updated version of warfarin. They use anticoagulants of different, you know, brand names. But it basically causes the rat to bleed to death, and it's pretty disgusting. But the rats have developed a resistance to anticoagulants, which strikes fear in the hearts of anybody who pays attention to the issues, because suddenly you're saying the rats are stronger than the poison. And this first surfaced in the 1970s, and people in the cities talked about super rats that could survive on poison. But they have had reports of rats eating poison, which is a lot of times grain with poison, but eating the grain and surviving just on the poison grain. Mm.
As horrible as what you're saying is, it reminds me of cockroaches who seem to develop a resistance to poisons and who, you know, everybody says the cockroaches would survive a nuclear blast. Do cockroaches and rats inhabit the same places?
Well, yeah, and rats survive nuclear blasts too. In fact, they went to, in the South Pacific where they had nuclear tests, a rodentologist or actually a biologist who studied rats went in to see how the rats survived, and they did fine in their burrows. They found out later that there was just a sort of a slight, I want to say imperfection, but that's not the word, but a slight change to their jaw shape. But other than that, the rat survived the nuclear blasts. They live in the same place as cockroaches. They live in the places that we neglect, and rats are all about neglect. And you look at, for instance, the map of rat bites in a given city or anywhere, and you see the places that people are forgetting to care about. Rats are this indicator species, this blip that says, you know what, maybe that neighborhood, maybe we ought to put more funds into that neighborhood. Maybe that's the place we should care more.
My guest is Robert Sullivan. His new book is called Rats. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Sullivan. He's the author of the new book, Rats. You not only spent a lot of time watching rats on the street, you also did a lot of reading about rats. And, I mean, you learned a lot about rat characteristics. Maybe other people knew this. I did not, about the strength of rats' teeth. Talk about how strong they are and what they can do.
Rats' teeth can bite through metal and concrete. There's a scale called Moore's Scale of Hardness, and they're a 5-5. And that's better than steel. They can chew through anything. And I know an exterminator for New York City who adds glass to the concrete when he patches holes in buildings.
Why does he do that?
So that he does that so that the rat can't chew through the concrete. He'll hit glass and it'll irritate his mouth.
Wow. That's really interesting. Is that effective?
It's effective. It works for now. It works for now.
And what about rat reproduction? Like, how frequently do they reproduce? How many rats can one female rat spawn in a month or a year?
Rats, I think a female can have between 4 and 7 litters per year. And I think each litter, you're talking between 8 and 12 in a litter. And I read all kinds of numbers on how many rats there can be if that kind of thing goes on frequently, as it does. And the one thing that always stands out in my head is Hans Zinsser, who wrote Rats, Lice, and History, this amazing book about sort of disease and history. He compares the rats' ability to, you know, generate more rats to another species. He compares it to man.
Why?
Because the other species that does a really good job of moving into a place and eating everything up and taking it over and then running out of resources and fighting amongst themselves is humans.
In your book, you write that a lot of people confided their rat stories in you. Tell us one of your favorite rat stories that you were told by someone.
The best rat story ever, and it combines so many features of the other rat stories. The best rat story ever is my friend Stan's rat story. Stan, I made sure I got it exactly as I could from Stan, because I cannot tell it as well as Stan tells it. But Stan basically came home, heard something in the bathroom, heard a noise, a scratching noise, went into the bathroom, and as he put it, screamed like a girl. No offense to either Stan or the girls. And then he went back in and sort of made a scotch and like, what am I going to do? Oh, my God. And then came up with a plan. He'd read somewhere, back of his mind, peanut butter. They like peanut butter. So he found stuff in the house that he thought was maybe poisonous, put it in with the peanut butter, put it back in the bathroom. Because, you know, all of a sudden, all your environmental ethics, there's a rat in the bathroom. You know what I mean? That's what it comes down to. Life is down to the rat in the bathroom. And anyway, he went in, put the peanut butter on the floor, and made another scotch, and then went back in to look and see if anything happened, and saw the peanut butter untouched. And then I think, if I'm getting it right, you know, saw the rat up on the ledge of the bath and screamed like a girl again, went out, made more scotch. I don't know how he was able to do this after so many scotches. But anyway, it ends up with him turning on the tub and hoping that he can drown the rat. But then he remembers that rats swim, and the rat begins to impress him with a long swimming thing. Now Stan is panicked, and he's run back to the kitchen and taken out the last ditch rat poisoning effort, which is, I believe, Comet, the household cleaner. He pours a bunch of it in the bathtub. Of course, I mean, he's had a couple scotches now, so he's able to get that close to a swimming rat. But he pours a bunch of it into the bathtub such that it forms this green, you know, green thing on top of the water. The rat swims towards the green thing, and at the moment that it reaches the green thing, keels over and dies.
And then he had to figure out how to dispose of the rat.
And then he managed to use that thing that is so ubiquitous in cities, which is the plastic garbage bag, the plastic grocery bag, which if you fill it with a dead rat from the bathtub and then cut holes in the bottom, it drains easily, and then you go to the trash chute in your apartment building.
And it's got handles, so you easily just carry it.
It's got handles. It just seems like the perfect drowned rat carrier.
And finally, for somebody who found rats in their home, would a cat be an effective way of keeping the rats in check?
No. Cats can be killed by rats. This is a very important point. You must remember, a cat can eat a juvenile rat, could kill a juvenile rat, could stop you from getting rats. But if you had rats and you put a cat in the room with it, it would be like putting me in the ring with Muhammad Ali.
Was there a time in your life where you couldn't tell the difference between a mouse and a rat?
No, I think that you might think that you don't know the difference between a mouse and a rat, but when you meet the rat, you will know that it is a rat.
How will you know?
You will know because it will be so much bigger than a mouse, and you will know because of your reaction, which will be intense. And I know one exterminator who says he could always tell on the phone when people have rats. Sometimes they might say, oh, I have rats. But when they call him up and they have rats, he said, you can hear it in their voice. You know they have rats.
Well, Robert, now that this book is behind you, I wish you a life without rats.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for talking with us.
I wish you a life without rats as well. Thank you.
Robert Sullivan is the author of Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants.